This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents The Gilded Hour by Sarah Donati. This book is read by Cassandra Campbell. For my daughter Elizabeth, best beloved. Young as she is, the stuff of her life is a great cargo, and some of it heavy. I wish her a lucky passage. Richard Wilbur, 1921. Chapter 1, 1883. Early on a March morning on the cusp of spring, Anna Savard came from the garden to find a young woman with a message that would test her patience, disrupt her day, and send her off on an unexpected journey. A harbinger of change, wearing the nursing habit of the Sisters of Charity, standing in the middle of the kitchen. Anna passed 4 eggs, still warm from the nest, into Mrs. Lee's cupped hands, and then she turned to greet her visitor. The young woman stood with her arms folded at her waist and hands tucked into wide sleeves, all in white. From a severe, unadorned bonnet tied tightly beneath her chin, to the wide habit that fell like a tent to the floor. No more than 23, by Anna's estimation. Hardly 5 feet tall, and most of that composed of sharp corners, a chin that came to a point, and a nose and cheekbones to match, elbows poking out at non-congruent angles. Anna was put in mind of a nervous and underfed chicken wrapped up in a napkin. Sister Mary Augustine, she supplied. She had a clear voice, all polite good manners, and still there was nothing timid in her manner. Anna said, Good morning. How can I help you? I was sent to fetch the other Dr. Savard, but it seems she's not in. Her note said to wait for you. People who came so early to the house were almost always looking for Anna's cousin Sophie, who worked among the poor women and children of the city. For a scant moment, Anna thought of lying, but she had never learned the art, and there was the promise she made to Sophie. The other Dr. Savard is attending a birth, Anna said. She told me you might come, and I agreed to take her place. The pale forehead creased, and then reluctantly smoothed. Clearly, she had strong opinions, but had been schooled to keep them to herself. She said, Shall we go? Yes, Anna said, but I have to write a note first to say I won't be in this morning.
Well, you do that, said Mrs. Lee. I'm going to feed Sister Mary Augustine. If I don't, I'll have to explain myself to Father Graves in confession.
She took in the nun's hesitance, but pointed at a chair.
I know that you wouldn't want to lead me astray, so sit.
15 minutes later, finally ready to go, Mrs. Lee took the note to be delivered to the hospital and delivered a statement in return.
Your cousin Margaret wanted to talk to you about your costume for that ball.
She said, that ball, as she would have said, the fires of hell. Margaret should talk to Aunt Quinlan if she's worried. She's the one who made all the arrangements for my costume. Mrs. Lee's small, round face could produce a tremendous depth and variety of wrinkles when she was irritated, as she was now.
And what is a proper young lady, almost 30, might I add?
I'm not yet 28, and well you know it.
An educated woman of good family, an unmarried lady, a physician and a surgeon. What business do you have at a ball on Easter Monday? Easter Monday, given by that greedy and vainglorious Vanderbilt woman? Why,
Mrs. Lee, Anna interrupted in her sternest tone, tempering it with a smile. I made Cap a promise.
Would you want me to disappoint Cap?
All the irritation crackling in the air was gone, just that simply. Mrs. Lee loved Cap. Everybody did. Muttering, she marched back to the stove.
You and your auntie with your heads together,
Anna heard her say.
Only the good Lord knows what will come of that. and on Easter Monday.
Anna set off at a brisk pace along Washington Square Park, and then realizing that Sister Mary Augustine was almost running to keep up, stopped.
"Please don't slow down or we'll miss the ferry," she said. "I can run all day."
"We'll be there with 5 minutes to spare, even at this pace."
A flicker of doubt chased across the angular features. In the sunlight, her complexion was like buttermilk, with a scattering of freckles and eyebrows, the deep red-brown of chestnuts. Anna tried to remember if she had ever seen nuns wearing bonnets before, and then let the question go. Sister Mary Augustine was saying,
"And may I ask how you know that?"
"I grew up here, and I walk almost everywhere, and I have a clock in my head."
"A clock?"
Sister Mary Augustine echoed.
"A talent for time," Anna said. "The ability to keep time without a timepiece. It's a skill a surgeon must develop, you see."
"Surgeon?"
The little nun looked both confused and horrified, as if Anna had claimed to be a bishop.
"But I thought, isn't your cousin?"
"The other Dr. Savard specializes in obstetrics and pediatrics. I'm primarily a surgeon."
"But who would—"
She stopped herself, and two spots of red rose in her cheeks. She was pretty, Anna noted, when she forgot to be solemn. She wondered how much information she could supply without causing Sister Mary Augustine to fall down in a faint. She said, "Women generally prefer a woman, physician or midwife or surgeon, when they are very ill or in labor, if they have a choice."
"Oh,"
Sister Mary Augustine said,
"you operate on women only. That makes more sense."
Anna said, "I am qualified to operate on anyone, but I am on the staff at the New Amsterdam Charity Hospital, just as the other Dr. Savard, the one you hope to find, is on staff at the Infant and Children's Hospital and the Colored Hospital. And yes, technically, I am not allowed to operate on men, or so says the law."
After a moment, Sister Mary Augustine said,
"I suppose my training is quite narrow. I've never even seen a surgery."
"Well then," Anna said, "you must come by and observe. And we are always in need of trained nurses, if you should ever rethink your—"
She paused.
"Calling."
For a moment, Mary Augustine was struck speechless by such a shocking suggestion. Sister Ignatia would be outraged, as Mary Augustine herself should be outraged. But instead, she was struggling with a sudden blossoming of curiosity. She had been in this terrifying, exciting city for less than a year. During all that time, questions had piled on top of questions, none of which she could ask. But here was someone who would not scowl at her if she put one of those questions into words, someone who would likely even answer. She could ask this Dr. Savard what kind of medicine obstetrics might be, and how it was that a woman could become not just a physician, but a surgeon. Hot on the heels of this came the realization that Sister Ignatia was right. It was a mistake to let curiosity run riot. It would drag a person to places best left unexplored. And she still could not stop watching this very odd and unsettling woman doctor. Surgeon, she corrected herself, from the corner of her eye. It seemed to Mary Augustine at first that Dr. Savard was wearing makeup, and then realized that it was simply vivid coloring that rose and retreated in her cheeks as they walked into the wind. Her mouth was a deep shade of pink, but the full lips were also a little chapped. She wore her dark hair smoothed back and twisted into a coil underneath her very practical hat, without the stylish bangs that most young ladies wore these days. As Mary Augustine, Elise Mercier, as she still thought of herself and always would wear, were such a vanity allowed. She resisted the urge to touch the faint pox scars on her forehead. With her strong features and high coloring, few would call Dr. Savard pretty, but it was an interesting face with intelligent eyes, and she was clearly well-to-do. The neighborhood, the four-story house of a light-colored stone,
The heavy oaken front door with carved lilies and cherubs, lace at the windows, all spoke to that. But both of the Savart cousins had given up a life of leisure for medicine. Sister Ignatia would tell her to turn her attention elsewhere. The rosary, for example, which swung at her waist with each step she took. If she could get up the nerve, the first question she would ask the lady doctor would have to do with her clothes. Dr. Savard wore garments of the very finest materials, beautifully tailored, but without ornament and as austere as any nun's habit. Her hat was dark blue, lined in gray. A matching, widely cut coat fell in folds straight from a high yoke below her shoulder blades to the top of sturdy boots. Her leather gloves were of a deep, glossy black, with small brass buttons at the wrist. She carried a bulky leather bag, as all doctors did, and she let it swing a little at her side as she walked. There was an occasional glimpse of skirts swirling back and forth with every step she took, very oddly. That Dr. Savard was not wearing a bustle was not such a surprise. Few women who worked with the sick bothered with fashions. But the way the skirt moved puzzled her. Mary Augustine's own skirt swung wide with every step, so that the toes of her boots peeked out, first one and then the other. Dr. Savard was walking just as fast, but her skirts seemed to restrain themselves to a much smaller arc. With a start, she realized that the lady doctor was wearing a split skirt, like a man's trousers or sleeves for the legs. Widely cut so that she could walk without constriction, but trousers without a doubt. In the midst of Lent, Father Corcoran had given a thunderous sermon on the Rational Dress Society, which he took as proof of the continuing decline of the weaker sex. He predicted physical illness, infertility, and damnation. To her surprise and unease, Mary Augustine saw that such skirts were not immodest, no matter what Father Corcoran or His Holiness Pope Leo himself might say. They looked, she could admit to herself at least, both modest and comfortable. Something so shocking and interesting, and once again, she would have to keep her questions to herself. As they walked, Dr. Savard greeted almost everyone by name, the street sweeper and the baker's delivery boy, a young girl minding a sleeping baby swaddled in quilts and tucked into a crate, a pair of laundry women arguing in Gaelic. She called out to a very grubby newsboy to ask after his mother and got a smile in return. Everything taciturn chased away in that moment Dr. Savard spoke to him. In Washington Square, the trees were reaching toward spring, fat buds putting out the first pale green to shimmer in the sun. The city was full of such contrasts. Beautiful homes on wide streets lined with linden and elm and plane trees, and tenements so filthy and overcrowded that the stench filled the throat with bile. Little boys dressed in velvet toddled along under the watchful eye of nannies in spotless aprons, and a half-naked child crouched down to watch maggots roiling in the open belly of a dead cat. Every day, Mary Augustine asked herself what she had imagined when she was first sent to this great noisy city. In theory, she had understood what it meant to take in the poorest and most desperate. She knew that many of the infants would be sick unto death, and few would survive their first year. But she had never understood what it meant to be truly poor before she came to this place. Every day she was frightened, overwhelmed, and at the same time consumed by curiosity, needing to understand things that could not be explained. She cast a glance at Dr. Savard and wondered if it would be a very terrible sin to talk to her. And what penance such an act of defiance would earn once she put it into words in the confessional. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. I asked unseemly questions of a well-bred, over-educated lady in split skirts, and I listened to the answers. At the corner of Fifth Avenue, they came to an abrupt halt while oxen pulled two huge drays through the intersection. Florid red lettering on the first one declared that the profusion of potted trees,
some twice Mary Augustine's own height at least, came from Lamolt's conservatory. The second ray had a lighter load. Buckets and buckets of flowers, gorgeous deep colors and lighter spring shades. On the side of this wagon was a smaller sign, Mezzanotte Brothers, Greenwood, New Jersey. Mary Augustine couldn't help staring, but then she was not the only one.
I wonder what that's about,
she asked in a voice low enough to be ignored. Dr. Savard looked at her and lifted a shoulder. The Vanderbilts, she said, and their costume ball. She had ventured a question and got an answer. But that only brought 100 more questions to mind. If this went on much longer, Mary Augustine told herself, her brain would be riddled with question marks, hundreds of little hooks set so deep they'd never let go. There was a small market at the Christopher Street landing, but most of the stalls had already closed for the day and the ferry was ready to board. A great throng of people were waiting to cross the Hudson to Hoboken. Workmen of every description, farm women hung about with empty baskets and exhausted babies, towing young children on braided strings, still way-faced as they shook the winter off. Draymen leaning on towers of crates or huddled in groups that belched tobacco smoke. In the middle of all that, a nun who had been identified as Sister Ignatia stood waiting for them. She was the exact opposite of Sister Mary Augustine. From her habit, everything she wore from bonnet to shoes was a stark black, to the round cheeks and sturdy frame. Anna wondered what the difference in color was meant to convey. Young or old? Good or bad? And had to bite her lip to keep from smiling. The ferry let out a shrill blast of its whistle, which saved the trouble of another awkward introduction. On deck, voices rose high and higher still to overcome the noise of the water and wind and the engines. German, Italian, Yiddish, Gaelic, French, Polish, Chinese, and still other languages Anna didn't recognize, all in competition. Inside the cabin, it would be far worse. And so Anna began to look for a spot on the open deck upwind of the smoke and cinders. But Sister Ignatia had other ideas. She cast a stern eye in Anna's direction, and so she followed, suppressing a sigh. Somehow, Sister Ignatia managed to make her feel like a first-year medical student, always waiting to be told what she had done wrong. The cabin air was thick with coal smoke, rapidly aging fish, souring milk, pickled cabbage, wet swaddling clothes, and above all of these, sweat. The smell of hard work. Not unpleasant in and of itself. Now, said Sister Mary Ignatia, leaning close to talk directly into Anna's ear, how much do you know of what is before you? That this nun found it within her authority to question a qualified physician did not come as a surprise. Anna might have said, I have seen and treated smallpox many times, or I have vaccinated hundreds of men, women, and children, and even a priest or two, or, in the 4 years since I qualified, I have signed some 500 death certificates, more than 70% of which were for children less than 5 years old. The factory towns near Hoboken seemed to be always on the brink of a new epidemic. Smallpox, yellow fever, typhoid, influenza, measles, mumps, whooping cough, sometimes overlapping. There were measures that would have put an end to many such episodes, but the mill owners saw no reason to invest in the lives of the workers. There were always immigrants eager for a place in the silk and thread factories. It was only the intercession of the Department of Health that had brought about any change at all. Now the mill owners were supposed to supply hot water and soap. Hygiene was the first line of defense in all matters of communal health. And to see to it that newly arrived immigrants had clean drinking water and were vaccinated before taking up work. A few mill owners even complied, for a little while at least. But the epidemics still came, as regular as the seasons.
with the result that Anna now sat on a ferry bracketed by nuns. To Sister Ignatia, she said, "Vaccinations are not difficult. As long as there are translators to help explain, I anticipate no trouble. I am assuming there will be enough vaccination quills wherever it is we're going." "Vaccinations?" Sister Ignatia sent a sharp look to Sister Mary Augustine, and when she spoke again, her German accent had thickened. "Who is telling you of vaccinations?" Anna paused. "Wasn't Dr. Sophie supposed to go with you to vaccinate the mill workers?" Once the face framed by the bonnet had been very pretty, and still was, in the way of many immigrants from Northern Europe. Round-cheeked, flawless skin, eyes of a grayish-blue. In this case, there was also a chin set in the way of a woman who did not tolerate sloppy habits. Clearly irritated, she said, "We are the Sisters of Charity. It is our mission to see to the welfare of orphaned and abandoned children." Anna managed a small smile. "Well, then," she said with deceptive calm, "what is it you need me to do?" "We are fetching the children whose parents died in the last smallpox outbreak, but the law says no one is being allowed to cross into New York without a signed certificate of good health," Anna finished for her. "Italian orphans." "Yes," said Sister Ignatia. "But you needn't worry. Sister Mary Augustine has been studying Italian, and Father Moreno will be there to translate as well, unless you speak Italian." "No," Anna said. "Too busy with physiology and anatomy and bacteriology. But I do speak German. I studied in Berlin and Vienna both." Had she imagined Sister Ignatia would like this reference to her mother tongue and homeland? The older woman pursed her lips in a decidedly unhappy way. From Anna's other side, Sister Mary Augustine said, "What is bacteriology, Dr. Savard?" "Study of the origin and treatment of a certain class of disease," Anna said, relieved at the change in subject. "Bacteriology," said Sister Ignatia, "is nothing to do with us, sister. We do God's work among the poor children of this city and do not presume to aspire to anything else." Another time, Anna might have taken up this challenge. She had sparred and debated all through her education and beyond, often with people as intimidating and inflexible in their certainty as Sister Ignatia. A woman practicing medicine had many opportunities to hone her debating skills. But they were within sight of Hoboken, and in a few minutes she would have to take on dozens of children who had lost everything, as she had herself at a tender age. There had never been a moment's uncertainty about her own future, but the best these new orphans could hope for was a place to sleep, food, basic schooling, and the chance to learn a trade or enter a convent or seminary. A bell was ringing on deck, and all around them, people gathered their packages and boxes and baskets and began to move. Anna picked up her Gladstone bag and moved with them. Our Lady of Mercy Church lacked the fine statues and gilded angels and stained glass windows of the bigger Catholic churches in Manhattan, but it was full of light and very clean. Even the cavernous basement smelled of lye soap and vinegar, with no trace of rot or mold. To this unusual state of affairs came the presence of some 30 children, all of whom stood quietly, as if it were a matter of life and death not to draw attention to oneself. Anna took stock and estimated that the oldest children were no more than 11, while the youngest were not even out of clouts. And all of them were underfed and hollow-cheeked, confused, frightened. At the front of the room were three tables: Anna's station, where she would conduct her examinations and write the health certificates, a table piled with used clothing watched over by a tall, gruff-voiced nun who wore a tight wimple underneath a gray veil and who was never introduced, and Sister Ignatia, who ruled over soup and bread. The first boy to stand before Anna to be examined clasped a bundle in his arms, as though he expected her to grab it away. A piece of paper had been pinned to his shirt, which Sister Mary Augustine took and smoothed out to read on the open page of the heavy register book on a stand.
Santino Bacigalup, she reported, 12 years old. Both parents and two sisters died in the epidemic last week.
She squinted as she made notations. Anna took in the hard set of the boy's mouth and his unblinking gaze. She had the idea that if she were to reach out to touch him, he would lash out like a feral cat. Sister Mary Augustine said a few words to him in Italian, and he answered in a storm of syllables that left her blinking.
What was that about? Anna asked.
Sister Mary Augustine held out an open hand and shrugged.
I wish I could tell you.
He wants to go home to Sicily, said a voice behind them.
Anna was examining the boy's abdomen and didn't look up. This must be Father Moreno, who had promised his help as a translator. The priest was saying, he has grandparents and a married sister in Palermo. He wants to go back there. It's what his father said he should do before he died. The priest asked a question, and the boy's face lit up with happiness and relief. When Anna put her stethoscope to his chest and listened, he paused, only to let go with another stream of Italian as she nodded her permission. While the conversation went on between the boy and the priest, she palpated his abdomen and lymph nodes. He was undernourished, but very strong, as tough as a bundle of twisted wire. Through the priest, Anna confirmed what she could see for herself. Santino had not been vaccinated, but somehow he had evaded the smallpox that robbed him of his parents and sisters. While the priest continued his conversation with the boy, Anna walked across the room to a surprised Sister Ignatia. Anna said, "That child hasn't had his smallpox vaccination." Sister Ignatia frowned.
And this is important just at this point in time.
Is it important?
Anna took a moment to summon a reasonable tone. If his parents had been vaccinated, they would be alive, and he wouldn't be here frightened half out of his mind. Impatient, Sister Ignatia shrugged.
We cannot change the past, Dr. Savard.
But we can do something about his future. If you had just told me this morning, I could...
Anna stopped herself. Never mind, she said, and before Sister Ignatia could speak, tomorrow I will be at your door as soon as I have finished with my own patients, and I will vaccinate that boy and every child, everyone who requires it. Should it take all day and all night? Santino Bacigalup was still in deep conversation with the priest when Anna returned. Except the man who straightened to address her wasn't a priest. Instead of a Roman collar, he wore the clothes of a man used to heavy labor, a tall, well-built man with a heavy beard shadow and unruly dark hair that fell over his brow. He said, "This boy wants to work. He'll work to earn his passage home to Italy." His expression was neutral, or, she corrected herself, simply unreadable.
"You are," Anna began.
"Giancarlo Mezzanotte," he said, inclining his shoulders and head very briefly, as if her insistence on his name was untoward. But then he made a visible effort to soften his expression. "Please call me Jack. Most people do. Father Moreno was called away to give last rites, and he asked me to help here with the orphans."
His English was fluent and without any Italian inflection that Anna could hear. More than that, there was something about the way he expressed himself that belied the clothes he wore and his calloused hands. Anna touched the boy's head, and he looked up at her.
"Is there no possibility of finding work for him here in New Jersey?"
Mr. Mezzanotte leaned down to speak to the boy again. When he rose, he said to her,
"There may be something. I will talk to Father Moreno." There were belly aches and sore ears, rashes and ringworm, head lice and broken teeth. A girl of 8 had the vaguest of rails in one lung, while her older brother had a shallow puncture wound on his calf that was infected. While Anna cleaned and bandaged it, the boy told the story of how he had fallen down a long flight of stairs, consulting with Mr. Mezzanotte to get just the right phrases. His expression was so studied and sincere, and his manner so studiously dramatic, that Anna might have laughed out loud. When she did not, he shrugged. A philosophical actor with an audience that would not be won over. Few of the children were so eager to talk. These quiet ones she treated with as much gentle efficiency and respect as she could muster, answering questions with the thoroughness she herself had appreciated as a child. She looked up to catch Sister Ignatia watching her with an expression that was, for once, devoid of impatience. What she saw there was curiosity and surprise and a particular kind of empathy that made Anna vaguely uneasy for no good reason at all. The last children came in a group of 4. The oldest was a 9-year-old girl carrying an infant against her shoulder while she nudged 2 more forward. Rosa, Tonino, Lia, and Vittorio Russo all had masses of curly dark brown hair and fair eyes that stood out against skin the color of lightly toasted bread. According to the note, their mother had died in the epidemic, and a distraught father had turned them over to the church and disappeared. No one had any idea where he might be. Rosa Russo stood very straight with the younger children gathered close by, her free left hand on her brother's shoulder.
"I am American," she announced before any questions could be put to her. "I was born here. We all were born here. I have perfect English," she said in a rhythm that contradicted her claim.
She was a slight child in a dress 2 sizes too big. But despite ragged hems and collars, all 4 of them had been scrubbed vigorously, necks and faces and hands as clean as Anna's own. There was a dignity about her, in the line of her back and the tilt of her head, frightened beyond all comprehension, but determined first and foremost.
"Come," Anna said, gesturing them forward. "I promise I won't hurt you. Come."
Her voice quaking for the first time, the little girl said,
"We must go to find our father."
"I understand," Anna said. "But if you want to look for your father in Manhattan, I have to give you a certificate." She held up the printed form. "Otherwise, they won't allow you across the river."
"There are other places to cross,"
the girl said calmly. "Yes, but how will you get there? Do you have money to pay for the ferry?" After a long moment, Rosa shepherded the 2 middle children before her. The older boy was very somber but cooperative, while the little sister chirped and talked nonstop, mostly in Italian with a smattering of English. When Anna's attention slipped, 2 small, cool hands landed on her cheeks, and she looked up to find herself almost nose to nose with a very serious Lia Russo. The little girl dropped her voice to a conspiratorial whisper and said,
"Ayocchi d'oro. She says you have golden eyes,"
translated Sister Mary Augustine. Anna smiled.
"My eyes are brown and green, and sometimes they look golden depending on the light."
This time, Mr. Mezzanotte stepped in and translated for Anna. Lia shook her head, firm in her opinion.
"Doro."
"Well then," Anna said, "let me use my gold eyes to make sure you're healthy. Can you take a deep breath and hold it?"
When Mr. Mezzanotte leaned over to explain, Lia drew in a breath so fiercely and with such drama that her eyes crossed. She was healthy, and Anna was relieved. What she didn't know and couldn't tell was more complicated. Did the child not know her mother was dead? Or did she simply not understand what the word meant? Finally, Anna turned to Rosa Russo, who presented herself and her infant brother with an expression that was meant to be composed. Anna said,
May I hold your brother while I examine him?
Mama says no. Mama says...
She paused.
Mama said you will take him away from us, and we must stay together.
Anna considered, and then she leaned forward and lowered her voice.
My mother died on the day I turned 3, and my father a few weeks later. Every day I think about them, and what they would have expected of me.
The girl's eyes focused on Anna's face, looking for something specific there, some answer.
Did you have brothers and sisters to care for you?
A much older brother, who was away at school. Too young to raise a little girl. So an aunt brought me here to raise with her family.
Your brother let you go?
Her expression was torn between shock and disdain.
Why would he give you away?
It was a difficult time, Anna said, her voice catching. Much like this time is for you all.
There is no excuse, said the girl. He should not have let you go. Where is he now?
He died, Anna said, in the war.
He should not have left you,
Rosa said, almost incensed.
He failed you, but I will not fail my sister and brothers.
Sister Mary Augustine cleared her throat, ready to speak up in defense of a brother many years in his grave, someone she had never known and could not imagine. Anna said,
Rosa, I hope you are right. I hope you can do for your sister and brothers what my brother couldn't do for me.
By mid-afternoon, Anna was back on the ferry with the sisters and the healthier orphans, half of whom had had their hair cut almost to the scalp to stop the spread of lice. The children who were ill, a possible case of tuberculosis and another of measles, had been left in New Jersey to be cared for, though no one could tell Anna exactly what that meant to her disquiet. Also absent was Santino Bacigalup. Mr. Mezzanotte had arranged work for him on a farm somewhere in the countryside. When Father Moreno returned, he voiced the same objections to this arrangement that Anna had heard from Sister Ignatia, in a tone only slightly less irritated. The pledge of a significant contribution to the poor box finally swayed him. The priest looked at her suspiciously.
Are you trying to buy forgiveness for some sin? The church no longer sells indulgences, Dr. Savard.
I'm not Catholic, Father Moreno. I would guess my idea of sin isn't much like yours.
She blotted the bank draft she had written out on his desk and handed it to him.
And Sister Ignatia, who will explain this to her?
I suppose it will fall to me, Anna said. I hope that will count as sufficient penance.
The priest's mouth quirked, stopping just short of a smile.
The boy needs to be vaccinated, Anna said, before he goes to his new employer. That is possible, I trust.
Father Moreno said,
It will be arranged.
As she was leaving, he called to her, and Anna paused in the doorway.
I don't doubt that your concerns for these children are real and your intentions good, he said. But you are more like Sister Ignatia than you might like to admit.
On the ferry, surrounded by the children and the other passengers, Sister Ignatia did not hesitate to raise the issue of the Bacigalup boy.
You interfere, said the older nun. You interfere in ways that could have terrible consequences.
Doing nothing has terrible consequences, too, Anna said calmly.
Do not congratulate yourself. This is not a charitable act.
Of course it isn't, Anna said.
Sister Ignatia pulled back a little, surprised. No one ever does anything out of charity, Anna went on. Every choice we make benefits ourselves directly or indirectly. Even if it looks like a sacrifice, the alternative would be unbearable in some way. If I hadn't helped, I wouldn't sleep well. and I need my sleep. Gray eyes moved over her face, looking for some clue that would account for such an odd and disturbing philosophy. Such cynicism is unattractive in a young woman.
That may be, but it is necessary for a doctor and a surgeon.
Anna tempered her tone with a small smile. After a moment, Sister Ignatia said,
"It was a mistake to ask for your help. I won't do it again."
"That would probably be best," Anna agreed, "but I will still come and make sure everyone is vaccinated." One bench farther on, Giancarlo Mezzanotte was in deep discussion with Rosa Russo. Wedged between the man and girl were Tonino and Leah, while Rosa still carried the infant. There was something familiar about the man's posture, though Anna was certain she had never met him before. When he inclined his head toward Rosa to listen more closely, she realized that he held himself like a doctor taking a patient's history, weighing and measuring each piece of information, not because he thought the child was lying, but because her tone and expression told him more than her words ever could. It was an odd thought. The man was still dressed in his work clothes. He might be a carpenter or a stonemason or even a mill worker himself. But unlike most men of her acquaintance, he had a talent for talking to children, which probably meant he had children of his own or had grown up with many brothers and sisters, or as an orphan. He looked over his shoulder as if she had reached out to tap it and raised one brow. Somehow, he had heard her unvoiced questions. Anna gave a brief shake of her head. When he turned away again, she asked Sister Mary Augustine the question she couldn't hold back. "What kind of farm is Santino Bacigalup going to be working on?" But Mr. Mezzanotte had heard her. He turned around again, hooking his elbow over the back of the bench to speak to her directly. He had a very deep and resonant voice, but he still had to raise it to be heard.
"I sent him to my parents. They are floriculturists and apiarists, beekeepers."
The urge to tell him that she knew the meaning of apiarists and didn't need a definition was strong, but she bit down on it, banishing with it the long list of questions that sprang to mind. Such as, if this man farmed in New Jersey, why was he on his way to Manhattan? And why did he speak as though he had been educated for work other than farming?
"I see I neglected to introduce you properly," Sister Ignatia said dryly. "Dr. Savard, this is Detective Sergeant Mezzanotte of the New York Police Department."
Her jaw set hard, as though she had to bite the words off to let them go. An unexpected turn, but it made sense to Anna. He had a natural authority and an air of quiet competence. What he lacked was the condescension that she had encountered in police when she dealt with them professionally.
"I was under the impression that most of the detectives are Irishmen."
He flashed a smile that changed the very shape of his face, a wide, honest, open smile that felt to Anna like a physical touch.
He said, "That's true. The police force is primarily Irish."
"Just as most physicians are men," said Sister Ignatia, which put an end to the conversation.
Anna had the distinct feeling that the older sister liked the detective sergeant and thought well of him. More than that, she seemed to believe that he needed to be protected from her, Anna Savard. She might have calmed the nun's uneasiness by assuring her that she had no interest in the detective sergeant, and even if she did, she had never learned how to flirt with any degree of comfort. It occurred to her then that she wished she could flirt with him, just to see Sister Ignatia's reaction. Sister Mary Augustine brought her out of her thoughts.
"I'm glad Detective Mezzanotte is here to explain things to the little girl, to prepare her. It's terrible when it comes as a surprise."
Anna's attention shifted to the four Russo children. Despite Rosa's sincere intentions, they would not be able to stay together. The orphanages were segregated by sex. so that Rosa and her sister would go in one direction while her brothers went in another. Most likely, they would lie to her to make the separation less troublesome, Anna was well aware. They would tell her that she'd see the boys again soon. People told lies to children as if they told fairy tales, with complete certainty that disbelief would be suspended. Rosa Russo was not likely to be so easily misled. Anna wondered if she would lash out or beg or weep, or if she would keep her dignity as a way to protect the three children she saw as her responsibility. She would fight. That Anna knew with certainty. The agents of the health department were waiting at the dock, middle-aged men with great showers of facial hair, scowling even before the first of the orphans came onto the dock. Anna set off at a brisk clip, not stopping to take leave of anyone at all. After 4 years of study at the New York Women's Medical School and another 4 years in the clinics, hospitals, asylums, and orphanages of Manhattan, Sophie Adélie Savard had earned the title of doctor. And still, when the door of the Clabbered House on Charles Street opened to her knock, Sophie introduced herself to the man standing there without any title at all. Archer Campbell had an unruly head of red hair and skin that was almost translucent, as tender as a child's. He was a slight man, the kind who would never grow fat no matter how well he ate. His hands, large and as hard as a drover's, were ink-stained. A man might be distracted or distraught or cool-headed when his wife was in labor, but Mr. Campbell seemed mostly irritated. He scowled to learn that the doctor whose fees he had been paying was not coming. Instead, there was a woman, and worse still, a free woman of color, as Sophie had been taught to think of herself as a girl in New Orleans, one with a calm, professional demeanor who was well-spoken and willing to look a man straight in the eye. Mr. Campbell was the kind who would have just closed the door in Sophie's face had the note she held out not tripped his curiosity. This one was scrawled under the letterhead of the New York Women's Hospital and was short to the point of rudeness. "My dear Mr. Campbell, Miss Savard is come in my place because I have been unavoidably detained. She is an excellent practitioner with much experience, and she asks only half my fee. Dr. Frank H. Heath." As was usually the case, the combination of the low moan issuing from the back of the house, the note, and the lowered fee bought her entrance. Sophie glanced back at the driver who had brought her. She had paid him to wait an hour in case she needed to send for assistance, but she wouldn't be surprised to find him gone as soon as she turned her back. She would have to send Mr. Campbell himself if it came to that. It almost made her smile to imagine the affronted face he would make if she had to give him orders. The house was small but beautifully kept. Nothing out of order. Every surface polished, fresh curtains at the windows. While Sophie went about the business at hand, her patient's husband blustered at her and muttered to himself, his eyes turning again and again to the clock on the mantel as he paced up and down, chewing on a cigar stump. He wouldn't allow her to close the door to the room where his wife labored. And so he was there every time she looked up. Sophie wondered whether it was his wife's labor or the fact that he had no place to sleep that accounted for his growing irritation. "The first three gave her no trouble." He stopped in the doorway to interrogate her some hours later. "Why is this one taking so long?"
"This child is very large," she told him. "But your wife is strong and the baby's heartbeat is steady. It will just take longer than you might have hoped."
It was a relief when he left for work. Mrs. Campbell said, "I never wanted Dr. Heath. He's so rough." She had an accent Sophie thought of as New England, her vowels abrupt and all R sounds clipped away. "I wanted a midwife, but Mr. Campbell..." She glanced into the empty hall and still whispered, as if her husband could hear her from anywhere in the city. Mr. Campbell thought the wife of someone of his high position must have a doctor. Because there was nothing she could say to such a statement, Sophie asked instead about swaddling clothes and clouts and a basin.
You sound strange, Mrs. Campbell said to Sophie. Not American.
French is my first language.
Mine too.
Sophie turned in surprise.
I was born and raised in Benedicta in Maine, Mrs. Campbell said. Lots of Francophones in Benedicta, but I moved to Bangor when I was 15 and I gave it up for English.
Sophie said, I came here as a child from New Orleans. She hoped that the contraction that began to peak would distract her patient from this line of questioning, but Mrs. Campbell picked up where she had left off.
I've never seen anyone with your coloring. Your eyes are such an odd shade of green, and your skin.
I am a free woman of color, Sophie interrupted, and at the blank expression Mrs. Campbell gave her, my grandparents were French and Seminole and African, but I have never been a slave. A frown jerked at the corner of Mrs. Campbell's mouth.
Not white, she said. But your hair. They've got a name for somebody like you. I just can't.
Sophie interrupted. I was very young. I remember almost nothing of New Orleans. Which was a lie. She had been 10 full years old when she left the city of her birth, and she remembered far too clearly what New Orleans had been, the smell of seawater and bougainvillea, how cool the tile was under her feet when she played in the courtyard, the children's rhymes that still came to her now and then when she was very tired. She remembered the sound of her father's voice and the way he cleared his throat before he said something he thought would make her laugh. She remembered her mother's tone when she was happy and when she was worried, and when she decided she had enough of work and wanted to go exploring and Sophie to come with her. She remembered the baker's wife who came from the islands and told stories of the Iwa of Saint-Domingue, and Jacinthe, who had only 3 teeth but ruled the kitchen and could make the servants tremble with a look. She remembered the quality of light that fell across her bed when she woke in the morning. She remembered the war and the way the ground shook and the air itself seemed to scream. And when the worst had passed and everything and everyone was gone, she remembered the day Mrs. Jameson came to fetch her away from home. They boarded the steamboat Queen Esther on the big, wide, muddy green Mississippi, and she watched the city disappear behind her. Sophie would not share her story with Mrs. Campbell because people, most especially white people, born and raised in the North, could not, would not understand what New Orleans had been. Sophie hardly understood it herself. But her unwillingness to answer questions roused her patient's suspicions. Between contractions, she wanted to know how long Sophie had been a midwife, how many births she had attended. A deep line had appeared between her brows.
You do have training, I hope. Dr. Heath wouldn't send someone without training.
Yes, Sophie said, unable to keep the sharp edge out of her voice. I am a fully trained physician. There was a startled pause.
Oh, come now,
Janine Campbell said with a half laugh.
You don't believe that yourself.
Sophie could have recited the names of the 7 black women who graduated from medical schools in Philadelphia and Montreal and New York before her, but it would do no good. She could no more relieve Mrs. Campbell of her willful ignorance than her labor pains. Instead, she said,
I am going to make you some tea that will help move this child along.
Mid-morning, Sophie put a large, very loud boy with tufts of gingery curls in his mother's arms. Mrs. Campbell, panting still, lay back against the pillows and closed her eyes.
He's a fine, healthy baby, Sophie said, alert and vigorous.
He is disgustingly fat, said his mother. I wanted a girl.
The baby rooted and found the nipple. She arched her back as though to dislodge a pest and let out a small shuddering sound. As Sophie worked to deliver the afterbirth, Mrs. Campbell lay staring at the ceiling and ignoring the infant at her breast. From the window Sophie had opened came the sound of the street on a busy Monday morning. Horse carts, omnibuses, hand trucks, knife sharpeners and fishmongers calling out for customers, the wind rocking the spindly apple trees that took up most of the tiny yard behind the house. Nearby, a dog barked a warning. Sophie hummed to herself while she bathed the baby, cleaned his umbilicus, dressed and swaddled him. He was solid and hot and full of life, and he had been born to a mother who could see him only as a burden. There were tears running down Mrs. Campbell's face to wet the pillow when Sophie put her child back into her arms. Women cried after giving birth for all kinds of reasons. Joy, relief, excitement, terror. Mrs. Campbell's tears were none of those. She was exhausted and frustrated and on the edge of the dark place where new mothers sometimes went for days or weeks. Some never returned.
"I don't like to cry," she announced to the ceiling. "You'll think me weak."
"I think no such thing," Sophie said. "I imagine you must be very worn out.
Do you have no sisters or relatives to help you? Four little children and a household is more than anyone should have to manage without help."
"Archer says his mother raised six boys and never had a girl to help. He told me so when he first came courting, back home, that was.
I wish I had thought it all through right then and there.
I'd still be working at the Bangor post office,
in my good shirt waist with a sprig of forsythia pinned to my collar."
The most Sophie could do for her was to listen.
"The worst of it is, he wants six sons of his own. It's a competition with his brothers, and I fear he won't let up. He'll keep me breeding until he's satisfied, or I'm dead."
As Sophie worked, Mrs. Campbell told her things she would be embarrassed to remember in a few hours. If Sophie said nothing, the new mother would be free to forget about the secrets she had whispered, and to whom she had said them. Mrs. Campbell was drifting off to a well-earned sleep when she suddenly shook herself awake.
"Have you heard about Dr. Garrison?"
Sophie was glad she was facing away in that moment, because it gave her a chance to school her expression. "Yes," she said. "I followed along in the newspaper." There was a long silence. When she turned around, Mrs. Campbell said,
"If you are a physician, could you—"
"No," Sophie interrupted her.
"I'm sorry."
Mrs. Campbell heard only the regret in Sophie's voice, and she pushed harder.
"Another one too soon will kill me. I know it. I have money saved."
Sophie set her face in uncompromising lines as she turned.
"By law, I can't even talk to you about contraceptives or anything similar. I can't give you a name or an address. If you know about Mrs. Garrison, you must know that the males are not safe."
Mrs. Campbell closed her eyes and nodded.
"I do know about the males," she said. "Of course I know. Mr. Campbell makes sure that I know."
Sophie swallowed the bile that rose into her throat and reminded herself what was at stake. Chapter 2. When they had shepherded the children off the ferry, Mary Augustine let out a sigh of relief to discover that there were three omnibuses waiting for them. Even better, as far as she was concerned, were the four sisters who had come to help with almost 30 desperately frightened and unhappy children. 10 children and 2 sisters in each omnibus was manageable. Sister Ignatia was difficult in many ways, but she had no equal when it came to planning. Mary Augustine had just crouched down to encourage a trembling and teary 6-year-old called Giorgio when an older man came off the ferry, walking very slowly. As soon as he was on solid ground, he simply sat down where he stood and began to fan himself with his hat. There was sweat on his brow and his color was ashen. This might be simple seasickness or something far worse. Mary Augustine tried to get Sister Ignatia's attention, but at that moment a scuffle broke out in the crowd of people waiting to board for the next crossing. Two dock workers stood nose to nose shouting at each other, both of them strapped with muscle and both decidedly drunk. Punches were thrown and bystanders darted out of the way, some laughing and others looking disgusted, while all the time the old man sat and fanned himself and tried to catch a breath. Mary Augustine divided her attention between moving the orphans farther away and the old man who might be having a heart attack, and so she only saw what came next from the corner of her eye. One of the longshoremen shoved the other with such force that he went staggering back with an almost comical look of surprise on his face. Bystanders jumped out of the way of his pinwheeling arms, and in fact, the man seemed to be losing momentum when his feet got caught up in someone's canvas sack. In his last desperate attempt to regain his balance, he flung out both arms, and one slammed into Salvatore Ruggiero, 11 years old, newly orphaned, who had gone closer to watch the fight, but now stood frozen with shock. Man and boy went over the edge of the dock. Backward. There was a single heartbeat of utter silence, and then the crowd erupted. Sister Ignatia was shouting, her voice like a bullhorn over the noise, "Move the children! Get them away!" And still Mary Augustine hesitated, turning to watch as three men, one of them in the long navy coat of a patrolman, jumped into the water. Just beyond him, the old man Mary Augustine feared was having a heart attack had jumped to his feet to watch the drama, as nimble as a boy of 10. One of the omnibuses had already left, and so Mary Augustine got her charges onto the second one as quickly and calmly as could be managed. She was hesitating about whether to go see if she was needed on the dock when Sister Ignatia came marching up and grabbed her by the elbow to turn her around. Her color was high, but otherwise, she wasn't even breathing hard. "The boy knocked his head. That patrolman," she pointed with her chin, "wants the third bus to take him and that idiot drunkard to St. Vincent's." She paused, as if an unwelcome thought had come to her, and then shouted over her shoulder as forceful as a general, "Officer, we will take the boy to St. Vincent's and nowhere else. Do you understand me?" The patrolman, young enough to be Sister Ignatia's grandson, swallowed visibly and nodded, but she had already turned her attention back to Mary Augustine. "So you'll have to get all the rest of the children into this bus. Sister Constance will come along, and you'll just have to squeeze together. I'll see about the boy." She hesitated. "Salvatore Ruggiero." "Ruggiero," Sister Ignatia echoed. "And send word when I've spoken to the doctors. Now, get these children away. They've seen enough." Rosa Russo confronted Mary Augustine as soon as she had climbed up into the omnibus. Anger and sorrow and disappointment all vied for the upper hand, but anger won.
"My brothers," she said. "They took my brothers away."
The separation had been inevitable, but it would have been handled more sensitively if not for the chaos on the dock. Mary Augustine said, "There are two buildings at St. Patrick's, one for girls and one for boys. You can see the boys' building just across the way, and that's where your brothers will be."
"At least to start," Mary Augustine added to herself.
Since she had come to the orphan asylum, she had seen children handle such separations too often to count. More often than she cared to remember. Some of them were too numb to react at all, while others collapsed or struck out. Rosa simply stood her ground. Her eyes were swimming with tears, but she didn't allow them to fall. She seemed to be struggling to say something, or not to say something.
"Come sit by me," Mary Augustine said, "and I'll answer your questions as best I can."
But Rosa went back to sit next to her little sister, the two of them sharing their seat with other girls. It was just then that she realized that the omnibus had turned from Christopher Street onto Waverly Place. She was wondering if the driver knew where he was supposed to take them when Washington Square Park came into view, and she made her way forward to the box, swaying with the jerking of the bus over paving stones. The driver was no more than a boy, but he handled the horses with ease and took no offense at her question.
"Your little ones need quieting," he said, keeping his eyes on the road and the traffic. "Upset as they are, I thought I'd take them through the park, distract them a little from that sad business at the ferry."
It was something Mary Augustine had yet to figure out. How it could be that some city dwellers were so coarse and rude, while others showed tremendous kindness and generosity of spirit. She thanked the driver and went back to her place, signaling to Sister Constance that all was well. And in fact, the children had quieted. All of them were turned toward the windows, leaning against each other to make the most of the space available, pointing to things they couldn't name. With some effort, she summoned her Italian and tried to put names to things they asked about. They pointed to trees and walkways and children being pushed in prams, to the houses that lined Waverly Place, tall red brick homes that must look like palaces to children who grew up in tenements. Rosa Russo wanted to know what kind of people would live in such a place, if they were kings and queens.
"Just people," Mary Augustine told her. "Families."
Her eyes narrowing, Rosa said,
"Do you know any of those families?"
Mary bit back her smile.
"Not in these houses, but down the street,"
she pointed down Waverly.
"You see the building with the towers?"
"A church," Rosa said.
Mary Augustine was sure it wasn't a church, but neither did she know what such a grand building might be. The driver rescued her by calling over his shoulder.
"That's New York University," he said. "Looks a lot like a church. I'll grant you that."
"Rosa," Sister Mary Augustine said, "I do know somebody who lives just ahead, and so do you. Dr. Savard, who examined you before we got on the ferry. She lives a little beyond the university, with her aunt and cousin in a house with angels over the door and a great big garden, as big as the house itself, with a pergola and chickens."
There was absolute silence while Rosa translated for the other children, and then a dozen more questions came shooting at her. Mary Augustine answered, and Rosa translated while the horses plodded forward under trees heavy with buds, just beginning to open to the sun. The duty sergeant at 333 Mulberry looked up through a twisted thicket of graying brows and ran his gaze over Jack Mezzanotte, from beard stubble down to the highly polished shoes and back again. Then he shook his head slowly, like a long-suffering teacher.
"Better get a move on, Mezzanotte. They're about to start the meeting without you."
"Had to change," Jack called over his shoulder as he sprinted up the stairs two at a time. Really, he should have stopped to see the barber. He ran a hand over the bristle on his jaw, but better unshaved than late. He paused long enough to make sure that his collar was straight and slipped into the back of the room, where 30 of New York's detectives sat talking among themselves, steadfastly ignoring the man at the front of the room. He found a chair next to his partner in the last row. Oscar Maroney had a dearly held theory, one Jack had never been able to disprove. It was best to be humorless and forgettable while in the station house. Invisibility was a valuable skill that had to be practiced. But today, Maroney was violating his own rule, because the expression on his face was anything but blank. Oscar was not just unhappy, but unhappy in a way he would not be able to keep to himself.
"Brace yourself, Jack."
Maroney could summon, temper, or banish his brogue as needed, and now it simmered just below the surface.
"Comstock's on the hunt for victims. Pardon, I mean volunteers."
He wrinkled his substantial nose and lifted a lip at the same time so that his mustache jumped. He had a wide range of insulted, angry, accusatory, and reproachful expressions, and he used more than a few of them now. Jack turned his attention to the front of the room, where the captain stood leaning against the wall, arms folded, chin on his chest. Front and center was the focus of Oscar's hate. Anthony Comstock, dressed as he always was, summer and winter, in a black wool suit somber enough for a pulpit. The postal inspector was a squat, solid plug of a man, with mutton chop whiskers that stood out like bristles on the face of a boar, a shiny, pale pate, and a small mouth as well defined as a woman's. He had the censorious gaze of a bantam rooster, his eyes darting back and forth, ready to draw blood to keep his flock in line, eager to draw blood. He was a bully of the first order, the worst Jack had ever seen in a career populated by bullies. Baker knocked on the wall to get their attention, and Comstock threw his shoulders back and raised his arms like an orchestra conductor.
"My name and mission will be well known to you," he began. "I am Anthony Comstock, Senior Inspector of the Society for the Suppression of Vice and Special Agent to the Post Office by appointment of the Postmaster General of the President's Cabinet. I'm here to talk to you as officers of the law about a matter of grave importance."
He drew in a ponderous breath that filled his cheeks and escaped with a soft hiss.
"Any God-fearing thinking man knows that lust is the boon companion of all other crimes. In their wisdom, the Congress of this great country has vested me with the responsibility of stopping the posting, sale, loan, exhibition, advertisement, publishing, dissemination, or possession of the obscene and profane. You will all be familiar with the kinds of materials I'm talking about."
He paused, brows raised, as though he hoped someone would contradict him. Jack saw now that there was a small box beside him on the desk, on which he rested a fist, as if to keep some vermin safely within.
"His own personal treasure chest,"
Maroney said in a low voice, following Jack's gaze.
"The Larkin brothers are determined to have it before he leaves the building."
There were five Larkin brothers on the force. Two of them, sergeant detectives sitting in the front row, two more roundsmen on duty somewhere in the city, and the youngest new to the force. Good officers, for the most part, but irreverent practical jokers of the First Order, a leaning that would have cost them friends if they had not practiced on each other with such obvious enjoyment. But they couldn't be called incorruptible. Of course, Comstock was by far the biggest crook, and worse, he was spiteful, vengeful, and mean to the bone. In Comstock's case, Jack could not begrudge the Larkins whatever larceny they were planning. Comstock was saying,
"It is also my duty to seize any drug or instrument of any kind that may interfere with conception or bring on abortion. Items I have seized range from informational booklets to objects made of rubber and designed for immoral purposes. The punishment for the guilty is severe. Anyone engaged in these pursuits is subject to a sentence of hard labor for a minimum of 6 months and a maximum of 5 years, and a fine of up to $2,000.
He paused to survey the room. Most of the squad looked back at him as if they were deaf and hadn't taken in a word, while a few others, Maroney among them, were openly contemptuous.
"In the last 5 years, we agents of the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice have seized and destroyed more than 25 tons of obscene tracts and photographs, 600 pounds of books, some 20,000 stereopticon plates, almost 100,000 rubber articles, 600 decks of indecent playing cards, 40,000 pounds of aphrodisiacs, and 8 tons of gambling and lottery materials."
He looked around the room but did not find the acknowledgement he believed his due. He coughed nervously and went on in a grimmer tone. Today I am here to recruit detectives to assist in fighting an epidemic that is raging across this country. A disease is being spread by medical practitioners themselves, and not just charlatans or low men, no. Doctors, nurses, druggists, and midwives supply information and instructions on contraceptive methods to any woman who asks. And worse, they will sell syringes and rubber caps and the like without compunction or shame. And then there are the abortionists. I have been able to bring only a small portion of these criminals to justice. It is a slow process, regrettably slow. Our success rate must be improved by whatever means necessary.
He smirked, openly prideful.
You'll remember the abortionist, Madame Dubois, I'm sure.
Jack had allowed his mind to wander off to other matters, but with the mention of Madame Dubois, his attention snapped back to Comstock. The man had hooked his thumbs in the lapels of his coat and was rocking back and forth on his heels, delighted with himself.
Rather than submit to the authority of the court, Comstock went on with his satisfied smirk, Dubois put a bullet in her brain and saved us the cost of bringing her to trial. She was not the first such sinner to end her own life, and if I have my way, she will not be the last.
Oscar jumped to his feet.
And you call yourself a Christian, you sanctimonious, overweening, godforsaken bag of shite!
Oscar was a big man with the look of a brawler, the kind who dealt out pain but didn't feel his own broken knuckles and torn flesh until the storm was done. Comstock, shorter and softer, still didn't flinch, which went along with his reputation as a brawler of another kind. He carried a pistol, and he liked to use it. Baker put a stop to it with a shout,
Maroney!
Oscar's posture relaxed just enough to let Jack know he was in control of himself. Then he turned on his heel and pushed past the row of men on his way out, cursing in the most spectacular manner. The door slammed behind him with such force that the glass in the window panes rattled.
Did you hear that, man? Comstock barked at Baker. I demand that he be officially reprimanded for his foul and profane language. That's one of the officers who found your Mrs. Dubois in a bathtub full of her own blood, Baker said. His first day on the job, it was. Now why don't you just get on with it? We don't have all day.
Comstock huffed, his mouth twitching. With a voice gone hoarse, he said,
I'll do that, but assured. I'll report him for his profanity and you for failing to check it.
He scowled expressively at his audience, as if he had demonstrated an important lesson they should remember.
As you are aware, he went on, police officers do not always see through the elaborate screens set up by these medical practitioners who are so contemptuous of the laws of God and man. But I believe that detectives are equal to this challenge, and I would like all of you to volunteer to serve as agents of the Society for the Suppression.
Baker said,
The time, Mr. Comstock.
Comstock whirled around to glare at Baker, captain of New York City's detective squad, as if he were a young boy caught with his finger up his nose.
Captain Baker, you agreed to let me address the detectives. There is a meeting of the society this evening, and new volunteers must attend.
And I specifically told you that you could not ask for volunteers, not tonight. More than half these men are working double shifts, and none of them will see their beds until tomorrow. They are on special assignment.
Special assignment? Special? By whose definition? May I remind you, Captain, that the Congress of the United States has vested me with Mr. Comstock. Inspector Comstock, Inspector, he roared, spittle flying. You will give me my title.
Inspector Comstock,
Baker said coolly.
Allow me to answer your questions one at a time. I find it hard to believe you don't know what's happening on Fifth Avenue tonight. The Vanderbilt's costume ball begins in a few hours. A third of the city's uniformed officers will be there to control the crowds, and more than half these detectives will be patrolling the area in plain clothes. Those orders came to us by order of the mayor, the governor, and the senators of the state.
Comstock's fleshy mouth jerked and puckered.
Where are your priorities, sir? Do you put the petty concerns of the dissolute rich above the welfare of the youth of this city? These men are not needed on Fifth Avenue, I can assure you. Where are your morals?
My morals are as sturdy as your own, Baker said dryly. And my priorities are set by my superiors. I suggest you take this up with them, because I cannot accommodate you or your society.
In the detective squad room, Maroney sat slumped, his legs stretched out before him like felled trees. A cigar was anchored beneath a mustache as glossy and thick as a badger's pelt. Jack said,
Sometimes I regret the captain's sang-froid. I think with very little effort, he might have caused Comstock's head to explode just where he stood. An opportunity missed.
I would have liked to see that.
The cigar jerked with every word. Jack sat at his desk to contemplate the stacks of paper needing his attention.
I'm sure we could sell tickets at a premium to see that baboon's head fly apart like a pumpkin,
said Maroney.
Set up chairs for the audience. Parasols for the splatter. The man has friends,
Jack reminded his partner.
Not true, Maroney said. He has lackeys. He has compatriots. He even has admirers. But if he didn't carry that pistol in his vest and the Postmaster General in his pocket, he'd be easy enough to squash. As it is, I wait daily for someone to put a bullet in his noggin.
Jack said,
You're forgetting about the Young Men's Christian Association and his Society for the Suppression of Vice.
Maroney waved his cigar like a magic wand that could make short work of such pallid adversaries. He was hoisting himself up and out of his chair when the door flew open and Michael Larkin dashed in. Comstock's box of confiscated dirty pictures clamped under one arm. Without a word to either of them, he leapt onto a desk, unlatched a high cupboard with one hand, and shoved the box in with the other. Larkin was sitting at the same desk, bent over a piece of paper, when a patrolman came in, not a week in uniform. The kid ducked his head apologetically.
Baker wants the whole station house searched, he said. Can I come in?
He made a quick and superficial job of it, only glancing in Michael Larkin's direction before he excused himself again and left. There was a long silence. Maroney cleared his throat.
Michael, my friend, not on duty tonight.
No,
came the answer. The eldest of the Larkin brothers looked up at them and winked.
All of a sudden, I've got quite a lot of reading to do.
Just out of the blue, said Jack.
Fell into my lap,
Larkin agreed amiably,
so to speak.
Would you care to have a look yourself?
Jack leaned back in his chair and propped his feet up on the desk. It had been a long day, starting at dawn in the greenhouses at home. He thought of the fairy, of ferocious Sister Ignatia and the orphans, of the lady doctor. Savard, they had called her. He bent over the report in front of him, but his mind stayed focused on that unusual face. Elizabeth or Mary, Ida or Edith or Helen. He fished the city directory out of a drawer and flipped through the pages until he found two listings. Sophie E. Savard and Liliane M. Savard, living at the same address. Another mystery. One he would be looking into as soon as he could get away from Oscar. When Anna came within sight of Washington Square, she realized how tired she was. Surgery was hard work, physically and mentally exhausting,
But even the most challenging case had nothing on Sister Ignatia and a crowd of orphans. Coming home was like shedding a coat with bricks loaded into every pocket and sewn into the hem. The tension that had collected in her shoulders and back began to abate even before the house came into sight. Some days she might lament the demands of her profession, but she loved the house and garden on Waverly Place without a single reservation. During the year she spent in Europe, Anna had worked herself to exhaustion every day so that she could sleep at night in strange houses and stranger cities. In the end, she had learned a great deal about both surgery and herself. She belonged here and nowhere else. Anna went around to the back, past the small carriage house and stable and the ice house, stopping in the garden to say hello to Mr. Lee, who was turning soil in a steady, studied rhythm. Mr. Lee was a serious, fastidious, and deeply affectionate man. He had taught her how to tell weed from seedling, to button her shoes and tie a slipknot, how to slip eggs from under a hen without being pecked, and he knew 100 ballads that he was happy to recite or sing. With a perfectly straight face, Mr. Lee had taught her and Sophie a dozen tongue twisters that still made them laugh. Anna knew that if she was patient, he would observe things in his quiet way that he meant for her to hear. Now he looked at the sky and predicted that, contrary to appearances, winter had not given over. It was an odd turn of phrase, as though the winter were a bear getting ready for a long hibernation. To his shovel, he remarked that neighbors who had already begun to clear away mulch would regret it. One more hard frost was coming, and it would take every unprotected, tender new thing in the world. It would mean the end of the crocus and delicate Turkish tulips that had begun to raise their heads, a scattering like jewels all through the fallow beds and lawn. Mr. Lee was seldom wrong about the weather, but just at the moment, Anna couldn't worry about such things. Not while she stood in the garden, knowing that in another month it would be warm enough to sit in the pergola in the soft shadow of blossoming apple and tulip trees. The garden was her favorite place in the world. As a little girl, before Sophie, she had had the garden to herself until the war took that away, too. When their father fell in battle, Uncle Quinlan's grandchildren were at the house most days, and from them she had learned what it meant to share more than toys and books and stories. Someplace along the way, Anna had fallen into the habit of calling Aunt Quinlan Grandma. But the summer she turned 9, Uncle Quinlan's grandson, Isaac Cooper, just a year older, had taken it upon himself to correct her. In a quavering and still strident voice, he made himself clear. She had no grandparents, no parents, nobody, and he would not allow her to claim his grandmother as her own. To Anna, she could be nothing more than Aunt Quinlan. She hadn't been a child given to weeping, or one who retreated when play got rough. What kept her temper in check was the look on Isaac's face, and the brimming tears he dashed away with an impatient hand. Anna told herself that he hadn't really meant to be so mean. He had lost father and grandfather and 2 uncles to the war, after all, and news of his father's death had come not 3 months ago. Beyond that, he was both wrong and right. Isaac's mother was Uncle Quinlan's daughter and Aunt Quinlan's stepdaughter, which meant that Isaac and Levi were not related to Aunt Quinlan by blood, as Anna certainly was. On the other hand, it did no good to pretend that she still had what was lost, and so she kept the sting of Isaac's words to herself. But Aunt Quinlan knew, because Isaac himself told her. He went to her, teary-eyed, righteous in his indignation that Anna would try to take his grandmother from him. Anna never knew what Aunt Quinlan had said to him, how she had put his mind to rest. But that evening, she called Anna into her little parlor, gave her a cup of hot chocolate, and waited while she sipped it. Then she simply pulled Anna into her lap and held her until the tears came and finally ended, leaving her boneless and trembling. Anna said,
"I want Uncle Quinlan back."
"So do I," said her aunt.
"I still hear him coming up the stairs, and it's always a terrible moment when I realize it was just wishful thinking. You know he would have come home to us if it had been in his power. Come home to us. To us."
Anna nodded, her throat too swollen with tears to allow even a single word. Then Aunt Quinlan had hugged her tighter.
"You are my own dear little sister's sweetest girl," she said, "and you belong here with me. When we lost your ma and then your da, every one of us wanted you, all the brothers and sisters. But I was the lucky one. You came home with me. And you may call me anything you like, including Grandma. My ma, your grandma, would have wanted you too, and I would be honored."
But Anna couldn't. After that summer, the word wouldn't come out of her mouth, whether Isaac was there or not. From then on, the woman who was as good as a mother and grandmother to her was Aunt Quinlan, no more or less. The garden might have lost its magic for her then, but for Cap. He wouldn't allow her to withdraw. Her friend, her schoolmate, another war orphan living with an aunt. Together they spent every minute in the garden, planning adventures and launching schemes, reading stories out loud, playing croquet and checkers and old maid, and eating, always eating whatever the garden had to offer, strawberries, persimmons, quince, apricots the color of the setting sun, blackberries that cascaded over the fence in late summer heat, and stained fingers and lips and pinafores. When it rained, they were in the pergola, which was outside and inside at the same time, a shadowy bower that smelled of lilac or heliotrope or roses, according to the season. And then Sophie had come from New Orleans, and together the three of them had made an island where Isaac held no sway. And so it had been long after they left childhood behind, until just 2 years ago. Mr. Lee broke into her daydreams by clearing his throat.
"Do you mark me, Miss Anna?"
He smiled at her, a lopsided curl to his mouth.
"Don't put away your winter things yet," he said. "Spring's in no rush this year, and neither should you be."
And now she had to go into the house and have tea and then dinner. And instead of going to bed, she would have to dress in the costume Aunt Quinlan had arranged for her and go out into the night with Cap to the Vanderbilt's fancy dress ball. Because Cap was her friend, and he needed her. Chapter 3. Aunt Quinlan's parlor was comfortable and completely out of fashion. No slick horsehair sofas or rock-hard bolsters encrusted with beadwork. No bulky, heavy-carved furniture to collect dust and crowd them all together. Instead, the walls were crowded with paintings and drawings, and the chairs and sofas were agreeably deep and soft, covered in velvet the dusky blue of delphinium in July. Sitting together with her aunt and Sophie and her cousin Margaret, Anna was glad of the respite. For a few minutes, there was no talk beyond the passing around of seed cake and scones, teacups and milk jugs. Her stomach growled loudly enough to be heard even by Margaret, who was bound by convention and simply refused to hear such things. She said,
"You haven't eaten at all today, have you?"
Margaret was strictly regarded, not a cousin at all. She was Aunt Quinlan's stepdaughter, raised in this very house by Uncle Quinlan and her mother, his first wife. 2 years ago, her sons had come into the money left by their father and set off for Europe almost immediately. Because Margaret missed them so, Anna and Sophie must bear the brunt of her frustrated maternal instincts.
"She'll eat now,"
Aunt Quinlan said. Mrs. Lee, could you please bring Anna a plate of something filling?
Then she held out an arm to gesture Anna closer.
At 89, the symmetry of Aunt Quinlan's bone structure was more pronounced than ever.